You're listening to The Central Cast, recorded each week in front of a live audience in Glendale, California.
All right, so because tomorrow is Earth Day, how many of you actually knew it was Earth Day? Nobody does. It's not a bank holiday. It's not a holiday we get off for work, so hardly anybody knows about it. I always remember it because it's also my birthday, so please, no need to get me anything. I'm turning 48. I do not want to remember it's my birthday. But in the spirit of Earth Day, I want to talk about climate change a little bit today and the intersection of climate change, ecology, and theology. The response to the climate crisis from evangelicals, I don't know if you've noticed, is pretty negative. Meaning, according to Pew Research, only about 1/3 of evangelicals believe that climate change is real and anthropogenic, meaning human caused. That means 2/3 of evangelicals believe that climate change is either complete bunk, a conspiracy theory, driven by the left, created by the left to end capitalism or something, where they believe it's real, but not nearly as bad as the scientists claim and not anthropogenic or human caused. The question, of course, becomes, what does being an evangelical have to do with what one believes about climate change or climate science? It's an interesting question. It seems strange to me that those two things have anything in common with each other. I mean, it would be like asking, why do most accountants not believe in the Apollo moon landings? Not that accountants don't believe in the Apollo moon landing. Obviously they do. I'm simply using that as an illustration to show how bizarre it is that this is the case with evangelicals not believing in climate change. But it's not hard to understand why, once one understands that evangelicalism is at least as much political as it is religious, and probably even more so political than religious these days. Many evangelicals believe that climate science and climate change is part of this secular left agenda to destroy America, Christianity, perhaps even. They see climate change, abortion, critical race theory, the gay rights movement, and socialism as all part of this secular left agenda that is both anti-American and anti-Christian. The main reason why they believe this is because evangelicalism was merged with the GOP and in general the right wing at least 40 years ago, probably starting back in the 1970s, so 50 years ago. Thus, right-wing politics had become theologized or given the God stamp among conservative American Christians, aka evangelicals. And for this reason, many evangelicals would actually say that creation was made for us to exploit. The world was made for us, not us for the world. The world was made for us to use and exploit and for our own personal betterment as a species. Therefore, having a kind of exploitative relationship with it is our God-given right. I mean, I grew up kind of thinking this way. You know, the world was made for us, not us for the world. We were given dominion over the animals and over all that was made, right? So we're told in Genesis. And evangelicals often believe, and I know I grew up believing this, that since creation is fallen because of Adam and Eve's original sin, right? All of creation is polluted with original sin, not just us, but the natural world as well. This is where suffering and death, natural disasters, disease, predation, this is where these things come from. I remember my dad once telling me that the reason why lions have sharp teeth is so that God created them that way so that they could eat the bark off of trees. It wasn't so that they didn't have huge canines to kill other animals with. No, it's to eat hair bark off of trees, right? This is the kind of intellectual gymnastics you have to go through. At least I had to go through. So because so many evangelicals believe that creation is fallen, then it doesn't matter too much what we do to it. God is going to make a new heaven and a new earth, we're told in the book of Revelation. So this place, this world is going to hell in a handbasket anyway. Let's just, you know, take what we can from it, make our lives better, exploit it, trash it, whatever. Doesn't matter. It's all coming to an end. God's going to make a new heaven and a new earth. So let's do what we want. Here we can see how one's theology informs their ecology, or how one's theology can influence policy and politics, especially surrounding environmental concerns and these kinds of things, climate change included. And yet there has always been Christians who have taken an opposite view and used their interpretation of scripture and theology to do so. These Christians would take their cues also from the Genesis creation story, where God tells Adam and Eve to be good stewards of the earth, to cultivate it, to care for it, to be co-creators with God, in essence, right? Christians have used that story to say, hey, creation and environmental care, this is our God-given mandate. Thus, environmentalism is not anti-Christian for these, but at the core of their faith, these same Christians would even point to the incarnation to inform this view, this idea that God became flesh, God became a creature, a person, in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. God became a mammal, became part of this natural order, became part of the earth. And so God, since God took on an earthly form, this means that the natural world is divine, not just our flesh, but all flesh. And we are from the soil, we are from the dust. And this means that God is from the dust, from the soil, you could say, or that all of creation is endowed with the spirit. And because so, we are to treat it with the utmost respect and see ourselves as stewards of the natural world, of which we are inextricably a part of, and so is God, as revealed in the incarnation. So there are some different ways, both positive and negative, that Christians have thought theologically about ecology and even climate change. But I want to pivot now and just take a moment defining what climate change actually is. I don't want to take it for granted that those of you joining us online or listening to the podcast later, or even the few of you that are present here today with us, know exactly what climate change is and what is causing it. And to be clear, I'm by no means, obviously, an expert, right? I'm not a climate scientist. But the basic gist is pretty simple to understand. When an object, i.e. the Earth, receives more energy than it radiates out, it warms up. An object must radiate or release the same amount of energy it receives in order to maintain equilibrium. It's pretty simple. It's like high school physics, I guess. Most of the energy the Earth receives from the sun that translates into heat is infrared radiation. A lot of that is radiated back out into space by being reflected off of clouds and glaciers and the oceans, et cetera. But what happens with the burning of copious amounts of fossil fuels, as we've done for the last century or so, carbon dioxide builds up in the atmosphere and makes the atmosphere, just imperceptibly so to the naked eye, it makes the atmosphere a little bit opaque, imperceptibly so by our own eyes. But it's enough to create this kind of greenhouse effect where a slightly higher amount of infrared radiation is locked in that otherwise would be radiated out. Thus, we have a net positive energy increase. And this means we're heating up slowly but surely. That's the basic physics of what's going on. And here's the unfortunate bottom line. Even if we were able to stop all emissions today, the damage is done. The extra heat energy that's been absorbed by the oceans cannot be undone at this point. The oceans have to go through their own cycle over the course of, I don't know how many years, in order to dissipate or release this heat. So the only question is, how much are we going to heat up? And keep in mind, we're not stopping emissions anytime soon, right? So the oceans are going to continue to absorb more energy and warm. We just don't know how much. So the general consensus is, we cannot stop what's coming. meaning we cannot stop the rising sea levels, the loss of coastlines around the world, the mass migrations that will take place as a result. There will also be mass migrations from the global south, it's believed, as a result of food shortages and increasing heat in the lower latitudes. There will also be, and we've already seen some of this, increasing freakish weather events, stronger storms, floods, bigger and more frequent wildfires, a reality here in the West. All of this it's believed will probably lead to a global economic crisis sometime in the next 50 to 100 years. We probably won't live, those of us here listening online, probably won't live to see most of these effects, but our children will, and certainly our grandchildren will. This is where we're at. This is what the experts are saying, the chorus of experts on this. And I know that can feel kind of depressing and hopeless and disempowering. We're told there's nothing we can do to stop what's coming. All we can do is maybe slow it down a bit, mitigate the effects somewhat, make some changes so that the earth doesn't warm up even more or a lot more. And the good news is there are things happening to do this. There are policies being enacted and new technologies being developed that are creating cheaper renewable sources of energy, but it's not happening fast enough. The question, of course, is, you know, it always seems to become, what can we do as individuals? Yes, we can recycle. We can change our light bulbs. We can buy a electric car or a hybrid. We can change our consumer habits, but that's only a starting point. And in the grand scheme of things, the fact is, it's not going to really do much. There needs to be systemic change. Climate justice writer Mary Hegler puts it this way. The more we focus on individual action and neglect systemic change, the more we're just sweeping leaves on a windy day. So while personal actions can be meaningful starting points, like recycling, they can also be dangerous stopping points. We need to broaden our definition of personal action beyond what we use or buy. Start by changing your light bulb, but don't stop there. Taking part in a climate strike or showing up to a rally is a personal action. Organizing neighbors to sue a power plant that's poisoning the community is a personal action. Voting is a personal action. When choosing your candidate, investigate their environmental policies. If they aren't strong enough, demand better. Once that person is in office, hold them accountable. And if that doesn't work, run for office yourself. That's another personal action. Take your personal action and magnify it into something bigger than what kind of bags you choose to carry to your grocery store. We're told climate change could have been fixed if we had all just ordered less takeout and fewer plastic bags, turned off some lights, planted a few trees, or driven an electric car. We're led to believe if those adjustments can't do the trick, what's the point? Somebody's benefiting, by the way, from that attitude. And it's the oil companies and, you know. The belief that this enormous existential problem could have been fixed if we all just tweaked our consumer habits is not only preposterous, it's dangerous. It turns environmentalism into an individual choice defined as sin or virtue, convicting those of us who don't or can't uphold these ethics, end quote. Again, that was Mary Hegler, a climate activist with some great insights. And I think that's a really helpful way of thinking about the climate crisis and environmental activism. It really should be understood as a critique of power, a critique of empire, a critique of the rulers and authorities, to invoke some biblical rhetoric. Yes, there are some things that we can do as individuals, but ultimately this is a systemic problem that only really has systemic solutions. But again, at the end of the day, you know, we can't reverse what's happened. We can't stop what's coming. There's a storm on the way. Nothing's going to stop it. We are faced with some dire things in the future. Nobody really knows how bad it's going to get or when exactly it's going to get really bad. But according to the experts, there's no escaping it. And for me, you know, this doesn't mean that we just give in to despair. And maybe that's tempting to do. you know, especially in light of all the things that we were talking about in the foyer earlier with Iran and Israel and the prospect of World War III and Russia and Ukraine. And of course, this is an election year and we all know what's going on. God, it can seem overwhelming. And then you add climate change to all this, right? That doesn't mean we give in to despair. You know, our species, we've survived a lot over the eons. We'll get through this too. I'm reminded of a scripture in Romans 8, which says this. This is Paul writing to the Roman Christians, the church in Rome. For I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all of creation. And to that list, we can add climate change. He's trying to be exhaustive in his list. Let's help him out. Let's add a modern concern. Nothing in all of creation, he says, will be able to separate us from the love of God, end quote. You know, Paul wrote this to Christians in Rome who were faced with some pretty dire circumstances. They were suffering terrible things. Perhaps it's believed some of them were being persecuted for just being Christians and perhaps even being killed for it. So they knew something about despair and hopelessness. But Paul's message to them isn't that everything's going to be okay. It's not. Trust in God. God will supernaturally intervene. Just pray hard enough and the suffering will be taken away and everything's going to be great. No. His message is, yeah, you're going to suffer. It's going to be bad. I take Paul's words here as a word of encouragement for anyone suffering from anything, because there's so much that life throws at us that can lead us to a place of despair and hopelessness, perhaps today more now than ever. I don't know. But we must remember and trust that love conquers all. To say nothing can separate us from the love of God, to me, means that nothing can separate us from the healing and redemptive power of love. Nothing conquers love, not even climate change and whatever calamities it brings. I've come to believe over the years that true faith is not certainty in the afterlife. It's not certainty that we're all going to get into heaven one day and everything's going to be sweet and the sweet by and by or whatever. And it's not certainty that if we just pray hard enough, God will supernaturally intervene and save the day. But for me, true faith, the true Christian faith for me, at least now, is a kind of faith in love itself. The healing and redemptive, life-giving power of love, meaning the love of life, and the love of others, of course. Which is to say that true faith is a kind of courageous affirmation of life in the face of all of life's uncertainties and inevitable difficulties and perplexities. To keep the faith means to me to keep faith in love's ability to carry us through, come what may. Our love for each other, and our love of life itself. This to me is the deepest source of hope that we have. This has always been the deepest source, I think. So may we as individuals be individuals of love and hope. And perhaps this is the best response we can have towards climate change and whatever it brings, whatever else comes our way with what's transpiring in the world these days. Love. The best response we can have is love and hope and love itself. We can find ways of easing the suffering of those most affected by whatever happens in the world. We can, you know, in our own circle of influences, make a difference with the lives of those we can touch, we can reach out to. We can trust in this. We can find hope in this. Hope and love itself, our ability to ease the suffering of those around us, come what may in the world. This to me is a source of hope. And it's grounded in love. Choose love and have hope in that. That's the message here today. All right. So I know there's only 6 of us here. And I know some of you are online joining us, but anybody have something they want to talk about or reflect on regarding anything spoken of? Yeah, Max, let me get you the mic.
I was just going to say, I recently listened to a podcast. It's called Factually with Adam Conover, that guy that does all that other stuff. I can't remember what it is. Remember, what is it? Adam Ruins Everything. Yeah, Adam Conover. You'd recognize him and his voice. And anyway, it's a really good podcast. But he had Dr. Hannah Ritchie on, who's a senior researcher at Oxford, and a climate scientist and data researcher. And she just wrote a book called Not the End of the World. And it was one of the most refreshing takes on climate change that I've ever heard. So, and it was just, I mean, she obviously knows her stuff inside and out. And all the factual things that you said, she's like, yeah, that's all true. And like, here are all the strides we've actually made, and here's how this is getting better. And she's like, I firmly believe that we can turn this around. And it just gives a lot of helpful ways to kind of reframe the entire conversation. Like you were saying, like the whole, there are literal campaigns to get us to give up, like, which is terrifying when you think about it. But like the all those individual actions that we know about were created by oil companies. Like, right. Like they are intentional about trying to make it a personal problem, knowing that it's impossible to fix as a personal problem. And so try being able to break out of that mindset and say, like, no. And with electric cars, right, it's like, well, you know, if the battery creation and the factory creation is not carbon neutral, then it's not worth it. It's like, no, of course not. It's if we're able to take out 80%, that is worth doing, right? Even if the 20% is still there. So anyway, it just gives really practical, really helpful ways of thinking about the climate crisis, and doing something about it. It's called Not the End of the World: How We Can Be the First Generation to Build a Sustainable Planet by Hannah Ritchie.
That's really good. Thanks for mentioning that. Yeah, there's a kind of like, you see that on the left. There's almost like this kind of like tendency to almost revel in the doom and gloom, and it's pretty unnecessary, but and also dangerous. I feel like to revel or like to get too doom and gloom about, well, it's the end of the world, But thanks, Max. Yeah, and we have to balance it with the fact that the experts are saying, yeah, it's going to be really bad, and people are going to die. It's actually going to, but it's, yeah, it's important to have that balance. Thanks, Max. Yeah.
That's very helpful, Max. This is the area that I find really doom and gloom. Most things I'm like, yeah, political or whatever, it's like, okay, zoom out a little bit and politics changes all the time, whatever. There was a study, climate emissions study in, I think it was 2017, that found that like 71% of emissions come from 100 companies. It's like this very small number of global companies that are producing all these emissions. Yeah, and then you get, you know, kids go to school and what they learn is if you just throw your plastic bottle away, then everything will be better. And it's like, well, how do you go up against the Goliath of the other, you know, of global industry that has trillions of dollars behind it? So I appreciate a little bit of reframing of that in the morning, because this is the place where I'm like, well, there's nothing we can do. Like, in the grand scheme of things, as myself, it feels so insurmountable. But yeah, I guess that's also where collective action comes in, right?
And thanks for sharing that. Other thoughts today? Yeah, Abe or Jason, then Abe. We're going to get
Stuck
everybody
again.
involved here that's present. I love it. Yeah, exactly. Go ahead.
Yes, love, but active love, performative love. Love that does something. Like, if you're gonna not just hopey, changey, feely love, but like, what is the action that I can take that exhibits the love of my neighbor, that exhibits the love of each other and us, and the communal sort of love? And we're in a really big conflict, at least in the States, between that sort of communal point of view and the individual responsibilities slash I don't know what you call it, but like that individual perspective that is, I'm taking care of me and mine, the car I drive is the car I drive, and that's what I want, and that's what I'm going to get. And that, and anything that you want to do that's communal is communism, is socialism, is wrong. And I want to, I would like to do understand when that switch got into evangelicalism. Maybe it was Reagan era. Yeah, that sort of like Western cowboy mentality that it's only, you know, I'm just taking care of my little part, and you should let me do that. I think that's the big conflict that we're fighting right now. We've been fighting for 50, 60 years, whatever. And yeah, anyway, just wanted to define that love a little bit more. It's not so vague. It's, you can specifically act out of love in who you vote for, in what you promote, in, you know, who you fight with, that kind of thing.
Yeah, good stuff. Yeah, Abe, would you mind passing that to Abe? Is an act of love for Abe?
let me preface this by saying, you know, the oil and gas industry has a lot to answer for, obviously.
Say that again. Oh, the gas, oil and
gas industry has a lot to answer for and all that. But speaking slightly in defense of the oil and gas industry, I think it's helpful to remember and to frame this as being not just what this horrible industry has done to us. Why have they done this to us? You know, it's the oil and gas industry and the energy industry in general supports an entire global way of life that is dependent on the liberation of massive amounts of energy from from these petroleum sources, basically. You know, almost every aspect of our life, the number of people that this planet consists of, that our current human population is only sustainable because because of the energy industry, you know, and so it's something that can't be reversed quickly. Like if we just hit a button and deleted the oil and gas industry,
massive,
yeah. Just be a, yeah, yeah, exactly. So it has to change. Like we have this, it's a very complex problem, difficult problem that really can only be addressed over the course of, you know, at least a few generations, you know? And so I think it's kind of like, I don't know, I have a certain degree of sympathy for the normal person that has a hard time conceiving of how you, because it's like, we really aren't going to see, like, none of us are really going to see that much of a difference in terms of, we're not going to wake up one morning and it's like, wow, man, look at this. We live in this, you know, the energy, you know, carbon neutral a paradise now. That's fantastic. You know, it's a long-term problem that humans are not good at even comprehending, much less developing political solutions to fix, you know, because we constantly want to have our cake and eat it too. We want to be able to live in really nice houses and have incredibly cheap food delivered from all over the globe to grocery stores that are right down the street. You know, we want all of these conveniences of modern life, but all of that is dependent on energy.
I mean, yeah, and there's a direct relationship between the increase in life expectancy in the modern West over the last 100 years and the industrial evolution that was driven by oil. I mean, there's a direct correlation between our ability to extract, you know, cheap energy from the earth and utilize it in all the different capacities we do, and the increase in life expectancy for hundreds of millions of people around the world. It's complicated, you know. It's extremely, you know, complex. But we're killing ourselves by, you know, poisoning the planet as well. So it's kind of like, yeah, you know.
Yeah, it's like we have to fix it. You know, I mean, it must be done. You know, we must figure out a way to generate the political will to actually make real changes to in every form that takes. You know, obviously at the federal government level, but if, like, you know, again, if lawsuits need to be taken against the oil and gas industry, like some of that stuff is happening, you know, that kind of, they need to pay a price for, especially like the misinformation campaigns that they, you know, that just slowed things down. That's what they did. They just slowed things down for decades, you know?
So, yeah, and the people that are going to pay the heaviest price for climate change, it's not you and me. It's right. It's those living in developing countries and the global South and the poorest people who are going to be the ones driven into mass migration because of the effects of all this. And, you know, you're right, Abe. I mean, it's extremely complex. And the amount of people living today on this planet is directly related to our ability to move products and goods and services around the world with ease because of shipping and aircrafts and everything depending upon easily accessible cheap energy, aka fossil fuels. I mean, there's no way to draw it, to say it any other way. I mean, it's been driven by that, and now we're going to pay a huge price for it. You know, that nuance is important to hold on to, while not excusing the oil and gas industries and the oligarchs of their greed and capitalism and the way that they are absolutely, you know, poisoning the planet. You know, I look at LA, I was a baby in the 1970s, but my understanding is the smog in LA was absolutely horrible, and how many people got lung cancer and all kinds of maladies as a result of that. But we changed a policy and began emissions testing and changing the way that we built engines and look. I mean, we still have smog, but if you look at photos from the 70s, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I mean, it's night and day. So change is possible. It's absolutely possible, and it's visible, and it can make the quality of life better. And that's just an illustration, an example. But I can imagine there was some pretty big resistance to changing automobile policies and emissions policies that the big car manufacturers and the oil and gas industry probably should have been. I don't know, but I would imagine they weren't enthusiastic about it. I have no idea, but yeah.
Yeah, it's just slow. Like, yeah. That's the reality, is that the effects will take some time to actually, you know, so it's not like they didn't flip a switch and then the smog cleared in Los Angeles. It's like there were policies that were put in place, and then over time, the air quality, you know, got better, and now it's very noticeable. You know, it's a very noticeable. Same thing with like the CFCs in the ozone. You know, the banning of some of those products. You know, it took time for the effects of that to actually sort of trickle up into the atmosphere and be noticeable in terms of studies of the ozone layer. But it did happen. You know, it just took decades to see those results.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Anybody else today? All right. Well, let's conclude a little early. Seems appropriate today. And let's do so by saying our benediction together. As we go from this place, we commit ourselves to the path of love, honesty, and humility. We dedicate ourselves, as Christ did, to the cause of justice and the courageous embrace of this life, this world, and each other. Amen. Thanks for being here, guys. And all of you, those of you who joined us via Zoom and listening to the podcast later, thanks for tuning in.